Welcome, everybody. Spiritual Sex Therapy, Season 2, Episode 18. David Melech Israel, Chai Chai Vekayam. I was waiting for 17 episodes to get to the 18th one, just so we could say that. I was just telling David that it's all part of the curriculum, yet somehow it's all perfect in this moment. And when I say that, I'm trying to express the fact that on the one hand, life is this unbelievable journey, and the soul somehow has so much to learn, so much to evolve through before, like the drop returning to the ocean, before it merges back with God. It has all these evolutions and different experiences to have. So, you know, I find myself listening to Ram Dass, and he's talking about the curriculum, and then, you know, I'm kind of happy about this, and I'm a bunch of different emotions, you know, that it brings up, and excited to, you know, be on this journey, especially with all you unbelievable fellow travelers along with me. But at the same time, I find myself getting scared. And I say to myself, okay, God, please don't, you know, come down too hard on me. I start thinking of like my sixth grade teacher who was a crazy, you know, tough teacher. I say, I hope God's not like that. You know, I hope God doesn't come down on me hard and really try to teach me a lesson to you know, skirt me out of one path into whatever path he wants. And you feel kind of manipulated, and you feel almost like, you know, I didn't choose to be a student here. You know, I didn't, my parents didn't sign me up. I mean, my parents kind of did sign me up for this, but it wasn't really my choice. And then I added this part of, yet somehow it's all perfect in this moment. Because if you state that it's a curriculum, and you don't also notice that at the same time, paradoxically, there's nothing to learn, you're going to end up unbalanced. So I think
can
it's...
Can I say one thing, Michael?
Please.
It's not just God, it's your soul that's creating your curriculum. You know, it's we as people, or you think of yourself, oh, I'm Michael. But there's another part of you, which is your soul, which is the true you. I mean, the person is going to die. The body's going to die, the person's going to die. But the soul, which is the essence of you, which goes through different lifetimes, that's the thing that creates the curriculum. It's not that God is... an external force is telling you, well, you got to take this course and that course. It's your soul that wants to learn and grow and heal and evolve. So that's my perspective. And I have other books that deal with that type of thing. So I would say it's definitely a curriculum, but it's you. The true you is the one who wants to evolve. Not coming from, you know, a deity or a god,
yes,
you know, like a teacher that's separate from you, telling you you better do this, you better do that. This is really you, and you'll know once you go in deep within yourself, you start to know and learn. You realize what your lessons are because of what you're creating in your life and what you're attracting in your life. So
sure, for
that's
sure,
that's what I would say. And it is all perfect because we're in the place we need to be. When we change and we grow, the outer world starts to change because,
absolutely,
you know, that's why you're in a situation. You know, the soul wants you. You know, someone said, oh, let's use the law of attraction. Okay, I'll just win the lottery. But that's not what your soul wants. You know, if that's
exactly
part of your journey, then you will. Then you'll win it because some people win it.
But the only thing I'll add is that, you know, it always comes down to this thing of like, where does my soul end and where does God begin? And that's why it's so hard to put this into words. But I agree with what you're saying. And I'll only add the thing, which is that, yes, the true self, the soul, is what wants to evolve. But the irony is that once the true self reveals itself to itself, it sees that there was nothing to learn at all, and it was already there somehow. And I know we've spoken about this before, but maybe some of these Zen things also could you know, shed light on that second part of that. Somehow it's already always been that way in that perfection, you know.
It doesn't contradict it, but it's just that it's in this stage of evolving.
Yes.
So it's part of the
paradox of time.
Yes, the part of
so
the paradox of time.
That's
it's
why
possible
the
for not what you said. It's also impossible for not to be what he said.
Exactly. Exactly right. 100%. And that's why I love these. That's why I put these Zen poems right over here. So the Zen poem states, if you want to ask where the flowers come from, even the God of spring does not know. Now, what does that mean? Well, Dogen explains that in the course of the seasons, the spring does not become the summer. And when wood burns, the wood does not become the ashes. There is the state of wood, then there is the state of ashes. There is the state of spring, then later the state of summer. So the key here is you don't have to necessarily link the thoughts together. Stop linking the moments together in a causal way, in a causal fashion. And when we really want to enter into the realm of God, in a sense, we need to transcend time. And the easy way in, as we've spoken about, I think that's the name of one of our prior classes, is the easy way in, which is Taoism, is simply to uncouple this moment from all other moments. You don't have to be a saint. You don't have to be any kind of perfect person in order to do this. This is almost like a cheat code. You just uncouple this one from all the rest of them, as if it was the very first moment and the very last moment, as if you didn't know of any other previous moments. So it's the linking of the moments together that creates the music that we know as past, present, and future. But as Alan Watts would say, the wake does not cause the ship. So too, the past does not cause the present. So when you see a wake of the ship in the ocean, of course, any logical person would say, well, there's the ocean, there's the ship going in the ocean, and that's what's causing the wake behind it. So the ship is almost like the present moment, and the wake represents what happened in the past. But nobody would say that the wake caused the ship. So too, you shouldn't say that the past that we conceive of right now is causing this moment. In a sense, we link the moments together to create this moment from the past. But in reality, it's the past that's being created by our understanding within this moment. And it's that very fundamental shift of consciousness that allows you to really arrive here and now. So I thought this is really a perfect way of understanding this. And what does it mean that if you want to know where the flowers come from, even the God of spring does not know? What that's trying to say is when spring comes about and the flowers come about, it's not pre-planned. It wasn't something that in reality is this led to this, led to this in the cosmic game of billiard balls. Really, in reality, when you're looking at that flower, it's just this moment with the flower. You could think of, oh, there was a seed, it was in the ground, and it sprouted, and then this and that. That's true in a scientific billiard ball perspective. But from another perspective, it's just the flowers are here now. And I deduce in the now about what happened in the past. So this is all a little bit intellectual. So now we'll try to open our hearts together. I was thinking about something Ram Dass said in one of his lectures, and he says, oh, you're feeling angry? Just give it up. It's as simple as just give it up. You're feeling sad? You're having depression? Give it up. Just give it up. And he almost tries to simplify it like that. And he knows, yeah, if you tell this to certain people, especially people who are in a severe depression, somebody who's gone through something really tragic. And he says, you've been abused as a child, give it up. Even to that degree, he'll say that. Now, I'm in a line of work where I encounter these exact things all the time. And it's not, I wouldn't so cavalierly just say, give it up. But I do understand exactly what Ram Dass is saying. And my aspiration for every patient that's under my care is that they could get to a point where they're able to just give it up. Because the point of talking about trauma is not to rehash it and rehash it and rehash it. It's eventually to give it up. And the same thing when it comes to sadness or anger or any emotions in this moment. You feel it? Oh, just give it up. So I'd like to read you this story that Ram Dass tells, and it's really a funny one, and it's a nice one. Just talking about his experience of giving up anger. So just a little bit of a background to the story. So Ram Dass was told by Maharaji, and Eli could fill in any gaps that I miss. Ram Dass was told by his guru, Ram Dass should not touch money. So this is just one of his things that he had to follow at that time. And Ram Dass was involved in scheduling a bus trip for a lot of the Westerners to go to the temple where the guru was staying. And everybody can't wait to go to this temple. And they basically, everybody left without Ram Dass, right? Ram Dass was left in the dust and he had no way of really getting there with, you know, another bus because he couldn't touch money and he didn't have money on him. So he had to walk for miles and miles and miles just to get to that temple. So he says, once I found myself becoming very angry while at Maharaji's temple, it was at that scenario. Most of the anger was directed against my fellow Western devotees. Although there were perhaps some justifiable reasons for the anger, the fever pitch to which it had risen at the end of the 2 weeks was surprising even to me. It was at that point that I walked to the temple and arrived late. All the Westerners were sitting in the usual row on the porch on the opposite side of the ashram courtyard from where Maharaji was sitting. From here, they could watch him from a distance while they were taking prasad, which was lunch in this case. When I arrived and sat down, one of the Westerners brought over a leaf plate of food that had been saved for me. Right, and Ram Dass is watching as all the Westerners are sitting there for hours laughing with Maharaji, and he's so jealous that they're getting this meeting with the guru that he was not able to have. And now somebody's greeting him with this leaf plate. At that moment, the fury broke out, and I took the leaf plate and threw it from across the courtyard. Maharaji watched. Almost immediately, I was summoned to his presence. And I crossed the yard and knelt before him. "Something troubling you?" he asked. "Yes," I said, looking over at all the Westerners. "I can't stand adharma," which means those behaviors which people manifest that take them away from God, or like bad behaviors, you know, kind of sinful things. "I can't stand it in them," pointing at the Westerners, "and I can't stand it in me. In fact, I can't stand anybody at all except you," he says to Maharaji. And as I looked at him, it felt that he was my only safe harbor in this darkness of my soul. And I began to cry. No, not just to cry, but to wail. Maharaji patted me vigorously on the head and sent for milk. And when I could see through my tears, I saw that he was crying too. He fed me the milk and asked me if I loved him. I assured him that I did. Then when I had composed myself sufficiently, he leaned up close and said, "I told you to love everybody." "Yes, Maharaji, but you also told me to tell the truth." This was another thing. Not only did Maharaji tell Ram Dass, don't touch money, he also told him, love everyone and tell the truth. So he says, "But Maharaji, you also told me to tell the truth. And the truth is that I just don't love everybody." Then Maharaji came even closer so that we were practically nose to nose. And he said, "Love everyone and tell the truth." The way he said it left no doubt about the way it was to be. For a fleeting moment, I had an image of a casket, apparently symbolic of my death, but it was shaped in a way that was unlike my body. It seemed representational of this conversation in which, in effect, I was protesting that who I thought I was could not love everyone and tell the truth, right? Simultaneously, that person could not exist. And Maharaji was saying, when you finish being who you think you are, this is who you will be. When you die, you will be reborn to love everyone and tell the truth. Then he said, sometimes the most anger reflects the strongest love. Looking across the yard at those Westerners toward all of whom I self-righteously felt anger, I saw suddenly that the anger was at one level, while immediately beneath that, at a slightly deeper level, was incredible love. Two planes of relationship in which a person might say, I love you, but I don't like you. And if Maharaji's instructions were to be carried out, and there was no doubt that they were, for he was my guru for better or for worse, the anger would have to be given up to make way for the love. Then Maharaji offered me a bargain. You must polish the mirror free of anger to see God. If you give up a little anger each day, I will help you. This seemed to be a deal that was more than fair. I readily accepted, and he's been true to his end of the bargain. It is now 23 years since that day. The impurities haven't fallen away as quickly as I would have liked, but slowly, very slowly, the mango boon is coming to pass. So I really like this, first of all, because you see, Ram Dass is a person like you and me. He gets angry. And there's another story that I read about him getting angry. You know, Maharaji's kind of gazing around with him, telling him, okay, make sure nobody gets to me before 6 p.m. And then certain people snuck in at 4 p.m. And, you know, Ram Dass gets a little bit resentful because they got to spend time with Maharaji and he didn't. And then the next day, same thing happens. And eventually, he's playing with Ram Dass to bring out the anger to the point where Ram Dass could learn from it and could learn to give it up. That's a guru in the form of a person that lives in your life. But the amazing thing is that for all of us here on this Zoom right now, in person, people listening to the podcast, if we don't necessarily have a person, a one person that's our guru, I think we could treat life as our guru. And as Ram Dass says, God, guru, and self are one. So this is what I mean by it's all part of the curriculum. Everything that life brings you is an opportunity to be part of the curriculum. So I'll give you an example from my own work. I'm in this clinic now, and it was, you know, slightly stressful at one point because we had to get the patient on like a Zoom, but for some reason my camera wasn't working, so we weren't able to operate everything as it was supposed to be operated. And the woman, one of the people who runs the clinic, she was getting really frustrated with me because the camera wasn't working. And I'm feeling the anger building inside of me. Like, I'm a resident. They pay me nothing. I'm here trying to be nice to all these patients. And I'm with the medical students. And this person is talking down to me like I'm some kind of nincompoop. Because the camera of the computer is not working, which has nothing to do with me. I'm a guest in this clinic for a month. So I'm feeling the anger welling up. And then I say, okay, hold your horses a second, Mike. Just take a deep breath. Let the anger go. And, you know, just bring love to this woman. And she's stressed and you're stressed and it's going to be fine. And I just took a deep breath. I put my ego aside as best I could. And I just tried to act almost like, you know, just very factually, logically. Okay, oh, it's not working. Okay, no problem. We'll call the patient on the phone. We'll do the part of the test that we can do. And we figured it out. And I went over to the woman afterwards and I said, you know, I just want to thank you for your patience with me earlier. I hope that it wasn't so much of an inconvenience. And she said, no, no problem. It's not your fault. And I realized how lucky am I that I didn't have this whole egotistical battle with this woman where I said to my, if I would have been like, excuse me, how dare you talk to me that way? I'm a doctor and you're not even a doctor. I went to medical school and you're going to mistreat me like that in front of the medical students? How dare you? I could have gone on this whole thing. And then it would have been very awkward for me every time I was with her. And I would have felt guilty because I love this woman. And she's extremely nice and most of the time. And she's extremely giving to a lot of the patients. So, you know, it's kind of like the feeling. I've regretted it so many times on the road. You know, when you're driving, I'm sure all you guys could relate to driving stories like this because it really could be tough, especially in Brooklyn, the way that people drive. And especially for me, you know, I have a lot of dreams where I'm driving a car, and I looked it up, and driving dreams really represent the journey of your life. So when you have a dream about yourself driving a car, it's very, very significant about where your psyche feels your life is headed. And I've had dreams where I'm heading over a ravine. I've had dreams where my car was hijacked. So don't tell me about crazy car dreams because I've had them all. But maybe in a little bit of a psychotic way, now when I'm actually driving, I'm like, I hope everything goes well because maybe this is part of the curriculum of the journey of my life. That's just my own little crazy psychosis. But sometimes I'll be driving and somebody's going about 4.5 miles an hour right in front of me. And I'm about 20 minutes late to work because I worked out in the morning, which I didn't have to. And, you know, I'm trying to get around and they're not going. And then either I honk or now I learned maybe not to honk. Really, I try not to. And then I'll honk and then I'll see. I didn't see that the guy in front of them was turning and there was a blind nun crossing the street. And there were, you know, seven children and whatever it was that I didn't see till afterwards. And then I say, oh, man, I feel so bad now. So that's kind of what life so often is. We get angry at ourselves. We get angry at God. We get angry at our gurus, our teachers, our friends, because we think we see what we see in that cross-section of reality, but we're not seeing the whole picture. You're certainly not seeing the whole picture in time, and probably not in space either. You know, like Louis C.K. has a very funny comedy bit. He says, how can anybody be an atheist? He says, like, you know, he's like, you have no idea if God, you can't even see like 200 meters in front of your eyes. You're going to tell me there's no God? You can barely see anything, you know? He's like, what if God, every time you turn around, God's just like, you know, popping right behind your back, you know, every time you turn around. And it's a very funny bit because it really hammers home in a very humble way the fact that we really do not see. We don't see what we think we're able to see. And anger comes from seeing a cross-section and making a conclusion about that. But the more we train, and by the way, anger is okay. It's okay to feel anger. It's okay to be angry and to sometimes slip up. That's fine. But what I would say is don't indulge in the anger. It's not healthy to totally stifle anger. No one's telling you to do that. But at the same time, if you're indulging in the anger, that's also not healthy psychologically. And medically, they tell you that's going to raise your heart rate. It's going to do all that bad stuff.
Not having
it. No, to indulge in the anger too much. Also, to when you stifle the anger, it also becomes very unhealthy. It could turn into all kind of mental illnesses, probably. And you know, psychodynamically, I think they say that depression is anger turned inwards. So what's the balance? The balance is okay, feel the anger and let it go. I breathe in, I feel my anger, I breathe out, I let it go. So
your IQ gets low when you're eating.
Really? I mean, for sure, your amygdala, 100%, 100%. I mean, your amygdala turns on and it's the part of your brain that's totally fight or flight almost, or it's like the animalistic drive. But my point to all this is when you feel the anger, the Buddha says, anger with its honeyed tip and poison source. So don't indulge in it, because when you indulge in it, you might think, oh, I'm just blowing off steam. I'm just allowing myself to release the anger. No, 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 honey. It's not going to be releasing the anger. You're indulging in it and you're going to reinforce it. And it's not healthy for you in that moment or later on. So feel the anger. Notice it in yourself. But don't take it out on the people and situations around you necessarily. Let it go or sublimate it into something. I used to go kickboxing for 6 months of residency. That's really good. You know, whatever works for you.
Pray for help.
Meditation. Always
ask for help, you know, because if you raise your consciousness,
mm-hmm.
It'll help. And then you also ask for insights, you know, what need is not being met, you know, exactly. And you delve into it, you could see, I mean, once you're calm, obviously when you're in the moment, that's, you can't really do that. You really want to, first thing to do is really release the emotion in a way that doesn't hurt anybody or yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you kind of get a calm, and also, you know, a physical exercise, yoga, things like that, walking, then you ask for help. God, help me, you know, guide me. What's the lesson here? What can I learn from this? What need is not being met that's triggering this? So, beautiful. There's a lot of reasons why people get angry. I mean, it's not all one thing, but there's always help available. I always feel like it's not just I can't figure it out on my own. I have to ask for a higher power to help me.
So the most beautiful prayers that we have, I think, are, you know, almost never asking for specific objects or events or anything, but almost always the most beautiful prayers that we can have are when we pray, number one, for wisdom and clarity from God, and number two, praying for to God, please use me as a vessel for your goodness. Please use my hands to help relieve this person's suffering. Please use my mouth to speak the proper words. And it's that type of prayer that opens us up and I think definitely puts us on the path of releasing those very difficult emotions. And welcome to ID. Welcome to Jeffrey. So glad you guys could join tonight.
Hi, Mikey. Hi, guys.
Got a real party up in here tonight. So now you guys are going to be jarred a little bit. ID, I'm sorry you came for this part, but I promise I'll explain what I mean by this. I wrote over
yes,
here.
Hi, thank you.
I wrote over Beruchim Abaim. I wrote over here, kill Franco. Now, what do I mean by that? So I want to explain, and this is my explanation. There's a great Buddhist saying that they say, kill the Buddha. What does that mean, kill the Buddha? Not actually, clearly not, but they're saying when you're meditating, and if you're using the Buddha, quote unquote, to help you in your meditation, kill the Buddha. Don't even cling to the Buddha. Don't even cling to the teachings of the Buddha. Let it all go. Let go even of letting go. Let go of everything. Now, why is this such an important teaching? This is a very high level of teaching, but basically it's trying to say, don't cling to anything at all. That's the real practice, is let everything go. Even the teaching of letting go, let that go too. Don't be dogmatic in your practice of meditation. When I write here, kill Michael Franco, what do I want to explain? So here's the thing. Right now, we're engaging in a beautiful dialogue, and I hope we're all enjoying it. I'm certainly having a great time. This is a highlight of my week. What's one of my fears? One of my fears is, something that Michael said didn't resonate with me. Somebody could, I know for sure people are thinking that, and maybe a lot of things that I've said have not landed with you or have landed on you the wrong way or something or other, and it didn't, you know, quite land right on your soul or on your heart, and it didn't really make you feel connected to God. It didn't expand you. When I say
here, never happened with me. It never happened.
I love you. You're my biggest man. I know I can count on you.
My heart is open when I see Mikey.
I love you. ID, it's mutual, by the way. Legit, it's mutual. But what I'll say is, when I say kill Michael Franco, please, I don't mean it literally. If anybody comes and tries to kill me, you totally misunderstood everything I ever taught in these classes. So you failed. You failed. So don't kill me, please. But what I mean is, in your mind, in your psyche, don't be afraid to let go of me. Lehavdil, just like they say, don't be afraid to let go of even the Buddha. So if the Buddha's teaching could say, kill the Buddha, meaning let go of the Buddha, because you don't want to make the Buddha into an icon, almost like an avodah zarah that you cling to. So too, I would say, please, for the love of God, don't cling to little old Michael Franco, because I'm just, kill me, exactly. Meaning, little old Michael Franco is just one little tiny iota of a manifestation of the whole universe.
But Mikey, why did it have to be so vicious? Why didn't they just say, don't idolize the guy?
Yes, you're right. So I think they, in their culture, in the Japanese culture, they understood this idiom. It was more of an idiom that doesn't translate well into English, because people will now think that I'm encouraging people to kill me, which is definitely not the case. Please don't. Right. But my point is, you know, the reason I put this in here, I've had experiences with teachers of mine, where I felt so much that their ego was so involved in their teachings that it clouded up the teaching of Torah or the teaching of truth or philosophy or whatever they were trying to teach me. And the problem with when the ego gets mixed in with the teaching is that you start to resent the teaching, or you start to resent the bigger thing. So please, for the love of God, this is me imploring you, and this is really, don't allow my ego and my shortcomings to color your understanding of deep philosophical, spiritual truths, Kabbalah, Zen, Hinduism, whatever it is that you're inspired by. Don't allow the flavor of Michael Franco to pervade it too much. Because if that happens, you're going to live and die with the teachings that I'm giving you are going to live and die by my stupid ego, which does not really matter. You know, so that's really why I wrote that. And because I know what it feels like when you have somebody who's so high and mighty on themselves teaching something, and then you get turned off from the teachings because of that person. So this is just something I want to bring your awareness to, is that possibility that could happen. And I feel like that's just a good self-disclosure. And I'm glad I was able to verbalize this, because I've felt this and thought this for a long time. And I'm sitting in the car today. I'm like, screw it. I'm just going to say it. And now here we are. So don't kill me. Which leads me to my next point, which is about actual killing, which is something that I've been thinking a lot about since October 7th. I'm sure as all of us have, it's impossible not to be consumed and thinking about this. But I pray and I hope that these classes could be a little bit of a respite from the psychological toll that it can take. And I hope and I pray that this can bring strength to all of us and, you know, real koach to Am Yisrael to finish off the terrorists as needed and to eventually bring back peace to the world. So what I wrote here is killing terrorists with an open heart. Now, what do I mean by this? And what do I think is a good Eastern text to learn from? Well, I believe really it's possible to do anything we do, anything, with an open heart. Even killing somebody that needs to be killed for whatever reason. If you're standing with your children and they bring a gun and you have a gun and they're about to kill your child and you kill that person, I think it's possible to do that without building up, as they say, negative karma for yourself. Now, how do I feel about this and what do I gain inspiration from? Well, the Bhagavad Gita. Exactly, but it's also this, it's pretty similar. But the Bhagavad Gita basically is one of the most ancient Indian texts. And it's a conversation here in the beginning between a man named Arjuna, who was like a prince, and the god Krishna. And I want to show you from this mystical perspective how they handle killing in a war when it's necessary. So what's Arjuna's dilemma? We'll skim through it quickly. After seeing fathers-in-law, companions, and all his kinsmen standing in the ranks of the two armies, meaning he sees that on the other side of the conflict, the people he's going to have to kill and slay are people he's like related to, but they happen to be on the other side of this conflict. Arjuna was overcome with great compassion and sorrowfully spoke these words, "O Krishna, seeing my kinsmen standing with a desire to fight, my limbs fail and my mouth becomes dry. My body quivers, my hairs stand on end. The bow slips from my hand and my skin intensely burns. My head turns, I'm able to stand steady. And O Krishna, I see bad omens. I see no use of killing my kinsmen in battle. I desire neither victory nor pleasure nor kingdom. O Krishna, what is the use of the kingdom or enjoyment or even life, O Krishna? Because all those for whom we desire kingdom, enjoyments, and pleasures are standing here for the battle, giving up their lives. I do not wish to kill my teachers, uncles, sons, grandfathers, maternal uncles, fathers-in-law, grandsons, brothers-in-law, and other relatives who are about to kill us, even for the sovereignty of the three worlds, let alone for this earthly kingdom, O Krishna. O Lord Krishna, what pleasure shall we find in killing our cousin brothers? Upon killing these fellows, felons, we shall incur sin only. Therefore, we should not kill our cousin brothers. How can we be happy after killing our relatives, O Krishna? Though they are blinded by greed and do not see evil in the destruction of the family or sin in being treacherous to friends, why should not we, who clearly see evil in the destruction of the family, think about turning away from this sin, O Krishna?" So you can feel and hear, you know, us, Am Yisrael, and also Bnei Ishmael, right? The Muslims that we happen to be fighting against in this battle, we're both descendants of Abraham Avinu. So if you're a very open-hearted person, you just came off a mushroom trip, you're looking at these Muslims, right, and you're saying, "We're Bnei Abraham, they're Bnei Abraham. How can we kill our cousins?" You feel this compassion, right? That's Arjuna's dilemma. Now, thankfully, they have these beautiful teachings. What do they say? So here's the teaching of the Gita. Begin with the true knowledge of spirit and the physical body. So Lord Krishna responds and he says, "You grieve for those who are not worthy of grief and yet speak words of wisdom. The wise grieves neither for the living nor for the dead. There was never a time when these monarchs, you or I, did not exist, nor shall we ever cease to exist in the future. Just as the soul acquires a childhood body, a youth body, and an old age body during this life, similarly, the soul acquires another body after death. This should not delude the wise. The contacts of the senses with the sense objects give rise to the feelings of heat and cold and pain and pleasure. They are transitory and impermanent. Therefore, one should learn to endure them. Because a calm person who is not afflicted by these sense objects and is steady in pain and pleasure becomes fit for salvation. So he starts off with this idea, number one, that your conception of having a separate lifetime that can be ended and that your fundamental existence will end, that is an illusion. This is in Hindu terms, but in Buddhist terms, they would say there are no separate lifetimes in the first place. There are no separate souls. It's all just one non-self. It's all just one nothingness that is also the self of reality. That's more of a Hindu sense. But it's saying we're all going to go through different senses, pleasures and pains, hot and cold, and it's an arbitrary dance of these different feelings. And you just need to let them pass and realize that they're transitory. But now here's the key. This is the kicker that really, to me, is very inspiring regarding this current conflict. The spirit is eternal, the body is transitory. The invisible spirit, the Atman, is eternal, and the visible physical body is transitory. The reality of these two is indeed certainly seen by the seers of truth. The spirit by whom this entire universe is pervaded is indestructible. No one can destroy the imperishable spirit, capital S. The physical bodies of the eternal, immutable, and incomprehensible spirit are perishable. Therefore, fight, O Arjuna. Now, here's the thing. The one who thinks that the spirit is a slayer and the one who thinks the spirit is slain, both are ignorant because the spirit neither slays nor is slain. The spirit is neither born nor does it die at any time. It does not come into being or cease to exist. It is unborn, eternal, permanent, and primeval. The spirit is not destroyed when the body is destroyed. O Arjuna, how can a person who knows that the spirit is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable kill anyone or cause anyone to be killed? What this is saying is, when you know this deepest mystical truth, you no longer conceive of that person over there in an absolute sense. And I'm not telling you to let yourself off the hook and go on a killing spree. What I am saying is, and this might sound a little bit solipsistic, but bear with me. From your first person perspective, the only reality that you can conceive of is from where you're standing. The only self that you can know of is from where your consciousness is coming out of. You conceive of different lifetimes all around you, based on seeing different physical bodies. But the deepest mystical teachings teach us the physical bodies are indeed there, but really it's all one self. It's all one spirit. We create a fiction in our minds about the consciousnesses of other people. We create theory of mind. We really don't know what the consciousness experiences in other people. We can know what consciousness experiences in ourselves. And I would hope we would give each other the respect and the assumption that other people's consciousnesses are similar to that of ourselves. But in a battle, in a war, it should be of some consolation that if God really is the real reality and the physical is this illusion that's hiding it all, it's Ote Orka Salman, Ote Shamaim Kadi Hashem is like stretching out the physical, stretching out the light to hide himself. When you're an Israeli soldier and you're going and slaying a terrorist, which is a necessary thing to defend your family and your nation, you do not have to have the guilt of, I just killed a soul, because the soul does not die. And the truth of the self does not die. And in reality, it's all one self. And you who are the slayer and you who are the slain, both somehow are one. And the spirit that knows itself knows that it cannot really be slain or be the slayer. So just be the vessel of whatever you're doing. Be mindful as you're doing it. But don't cling and don't have aversion in some way. Keep your heart open And as Ram Dass says, do what you do with other people, but do not put them out of your heart. And I think this is very beautiful, because you could even go to the degree where you have to kill somebody and you don't even need to put them out of your heart. And the Buddha even says in the Diamond Sutra, you can get to the point where you are the one being slain and yet you don't put them out of your heart because you don't conceive of yourself as a separate lifetime. And this is all, I know this is very high and mighty, but I believe really in some place in your psyche, in some place in your dreamscape, whether it's in while you're dreaming tonight or some place in the recesses of your consciousness, this is something that is healthy for you to hear. I don't know about the practical ramifications, maybe I kind of do, but at the same time, this is the teaching. And we might not intuitively sense it in the day-to-day, going to work, going to da-da-da. But the more we train ourselves just to be present from where we're sitting, not to make assumptions about other people's consciousnesses, I think the healthier we'll be in our day-to-day interactions. That was long-winded, but I felt for myself that that was very cathartic. Because it's hard. It's hard being in a war with people. It's hard knowing that we have to kill people. But to me, it's a necessary thing. And now that it's necessary, now that we've established we must defend our lives and ourselves and our people and our nation and our sovereignty for the sake of love and good and peace, which we are a people that loves life, and they themselves will say the Jews love life like we love death. Well, now that we've established that we must protect our lives, then, all right, how do we do it? How do we go about this war? How do we go about living day to day knowing that we're fighting this war and that people are being killed? I think you can do it open-heartedly. You don't have to put anybody out of your heart. They're saying Allahu Akbar and the soldier's killing them. He or she can kill them totally open-heartedly and compassionately and say, I wish you good luck on this journey of in the next lifetime. I don't see why not. All right, so we can pause here, or we can do some. Let's do one quick Zen koan, and then we'll move on to the lost princess. Unless anybody has any comments or questions in the meantime. Okay, great. So let's do one of these koans. This one's called Reciting Sutras. A farmer requested a Tendai priest to recite sutras for his wife who had died. After the recitation was over, the farmer asked, "You think my wife will gain merit from this?" "Not only your wife, but all sentient beings will benefit from the recitation of sutras," answered the priest. "If you say all sentient beings will benefit," said the farmer, "my wife may be very weak, and others will take advantage of her getting the benefit she should have. So please recite sutras just for her." The priest explained that this was the desire of a Buddhist to offer blessings and wish merit for every living being. "That is a fine teaching," concluded the farmer, "but please make one exception. I have a neighbor who is rough and mean to me. Just exclude him from all those sentient beings." That's the end of the koan. So I think there's a humor in this because, number one, it's poking fun at this concept of recitation of sutras as though that's really Zen. As though reciting things over and over again is really Zen, which it's clearly not. But at the same time, what does that create? It creates a misunderstanding in people. And there's a naturalness to saying, no, I don't like that guy over there. I don't want him to be at peace. But when you're really understanding Zen, you really just are wishing this goodness for all sentient beings. But it's showing here the mismatch between the priest and the guru kind of guy. And the student, really not a guru, the priest and the student, because the priest is trying to be on his high horse and say, no, we're very moral people. We wish for good for all people. And it's who's really the wise one here, which is what the story is saying. The wise one is this peasant farmer, the falah, the guy who doesn't know anything. He actually knows more than the priest because the priest is standing for something. He's clinging to a principle. And the farmer's being honest and natural, like, yo, all right, I know we should be nice to all people, but that guy, my neighbor, he's kind of a hamor. He's kind of an a-hole. I don't really want good things for him. And that's kind of more about the flavor of Zen than the priest of Zen. ironically. So I think that's amazing. A system that's able to almost poke fun at itself is a very healthy system. And that's the purpose of comedy in general. All right, so without any further ado, ID, you ready? We're going to get heebie-jeebie.
Let's go. I'm pumped.
So we're doing now a story called The Lost Princess. And just to give a very brief recap, we started off the Rebbe. This is Rabbi Nachman's story. He says that there was once a king and six sons.
Rabbi Nachman from Breslov?
Exactly.
My man.
He's the man. ID, you should have introduced me to him earlier. So he had six sons.
He's the guy I get in the forest. It bought their do.
Exactly. He's the I gay. So we're going to see that. It's going to come up here. Six sons and one daughter. He loved the daughter very much. He spent much time with her. We said the six sons represent like the six lower sefirot. The one daughter is like Shekhinah. And then what happened? And God spent much time with her. That's like before creation, it was just the presence of God. It was so imminent. And one time he was alone with her and he got angry at her and he said, "May the evil one take you away."
Wow.
And we interpret this as this is the concept of tzimtzum, which is when God removes of his presence, of his perfection, of his infinity to create space for the finite, to create space for the universe as we know it. And God is constricting his presence in so doing. And when it says that God inadvertently said this, it says, "V'nizreka mipiv," he almost said it by accident, "ke'ilu kibyachol," but it wasn't really by accident. It was really to allow for free will to exist on this dualistic plane that we're living. This is the way we conceive of how could there be infinity, which is all just oneness, and yet good and evil. And we'll see how this story is trying to help us transcend that. So when it says, "May the evil one take you away," it really means the no good one should take you. That's the literal translation. And this is seen as the shattering of the vessels during the primordial creation. Each of the sefirot is like a vessel. And when God's light shined through it, it was so overwhelming that there was what was called shevirat ha-kelim, the breaking of the vessels, and a scattering of all the sparks of God into all the corners of the universe, covered in these kelipot, in these evil husks. And this means that the power to perceive God would not be perfect in the world. So our
why is he whacking him out? Why is he saying that? Why? What they do?
We anthropomorphize it, but really it's not a moral thing. Really, it's a phenomenological thing. Meaning, it's explaining not a moral thing that God was actually angry, but it's phenomenologically God created the world by removing of himself and by shining this divine light into the world. But in order to create the world, we had to have a world in which the perception of God would not be perfect. Because if the perception of God was all perfect, all there would be God. And that's like Adon Olam.
But who's the one that's throwing the darts? God?
God is the one.
Yeah, but I thought Erech Apayim, he merciful for us. He goes cuckoo for us.
So not really darts. That's the thing. Is like we think of them almost like darts and creation of evil.
Right.
But this is the point of the story is to help us understand, okay, really what's going on and how do we transcend that understanding to see how God really is. Does that make sense?
I got it.
Great. So let's see. So there's no perfect understanding of God in the world anymore. And this is the human condition right now. It's explanatory of where we're at right now. We sometimes feel further from God. We sometimes feel closer to God. But we almost never have this perfect knowledge and understanding of God. And the reason for this human experience is because of this primordial story. The lack of perception of God is alluded to in the darkness that existed at the beginning of creation. And therefore, Rashi says that God's name is not associated with darkness because it says, "Vayomer Elohim yehi or vahi or." So God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And then it says, "Velachoshech kara laila." Vayikra Elohim la or yom velachoshech kara laila. So it says, God called the light day, and to the nighttime, to the darkness he called night. It doesn't say, and God called the darkness night. Therefore, it's like distancing God from the darkness. We have this intuition that even though God is infinity, God is less, somehow, some way, less associated with evil than with good. It's just an intuition we have. And this idea of the evil one or the no good, it's interesting because the 10 sayings of creation, we know represent the 10 sefirot, but what's the 11th saying? The 11th thing that was ever said is Lo tov heyot ha'adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone, and this represents the realm of the kilipot, which is below the 10 sefirot in a Kabbalistic way. Right, so that's an interesting idea. The original vessels consisted of the lower sefirot, corresponding to the days of the week. And since the vessel, which is the feminine element, malchut or shekhinah, was shattered, we would expect that the feminine element of each day would be damaged. And, you know, this is not saying women. I really don't want people to misunderstand this. It's in a yin and yang sense. It's like in a positive and negative sense. When we say feminine, we mean the negative portion of reality. And not negative in a moral sense, but meaning like darkness through which you could see light, negativity through which you could see the positive. We call it negative because, and we call it feminine because, you know, classically the female genitalia is receptive and the male genitalia is the one that's giving. That's really the only reason. And maleness is associated with creativity and femininity is associated with acceptance and kind of nourishment of that idea. So we would expect that the feminine element would be damaged. So indeed, the darkness and night are the feminine element of the first day. And God would not associate his name with them. And we're going to see every single day of creation has that like feminine element of it damaged, which is kind of reflecting the damage of the vessels. The second day, it said, the Midrash says the lower waters wept because the upper waters were able to be with God. So we're having constant re-emphasis of this idea of dualism. So you have the light and the darkness. You have the waters and the waters. The upper waters are with God. The lower waters are not with God. The third day, the fruit did not extend its taste to the entire tree, right? So the tama, etzke tama pri, was the ideal for the world. Like an etrog tree, they say you could eat the bark and it tastes like etrog, but the rest of all the fruit trees are not like that. On the fourth day, God reduced the moon in comparison with the sun. The fifth day, the female Leviathan was killed. And the sixth day, it was when Hava was first tempted to sin. So we see in each day is like this yin and yang game being played with the feminine side being in the one that's suffering. And that's going to be reflected here in the lost princess that needs to be saved. The fact that the feminine element was trapped in the realm of evil, represented later by the fact that the wives of the patriarchs were taken by the Pelishtim, right? So we know that both Sarah and Rivka were taken. So that's, you know, within our classic literature and within the Torah itself, we have these themes of the women being taken by the evil men. And even this idea of, you know, tremendous goodness being trapped within a lot of disgusting evil. David HaMelech himself is a descendant of whom? Of Moab. Who is Moab? That was the product of incest of Lot and his daughters. Okay, so David comes from that. And what about Yehuda and Tamar? Another almost incestuous, questionable relationship. David is the product of that. So it says in the Midrash, where did God find David? In Sedom. So it's showing you that even within the yucky and the icky is the beautiful and the pristine. And that's the way reality works, is we have a mixture, an admixture of Tovara. So Etz Hadaat Tovara is the admixture almost that we perceive of the good and the evil. And the job of all of us is to, you know, kind of release all the sparks from the kilipot to notice at the end of the day that really it's all part of God. And somehow we didn't see it. We perceived of this evil, but somehow, some way it was all part of God and it was all good, if we can even say that, which the words, of course, now fall away. And what does it mean that no one knew what happened to her, right? No one knew what happened to this lost princess. Malchut, who is Shekhinah, left the universe of Atzilut, of closeness, which is the universe of the Sefirot, and entered Beri'ah. So because Shekhinah is the lowest of the 10 Sefirot, it exists in this like almost liminal space between the upper spiritual realms and the lower physical realms. And it was kind of shot down into the physical. And God almost is like separating away Shekhinah from his realm into the realm of our physical reality. And you know what? Now it says that the king got upset. God gets upset. And it's very beautiful because even though it's anthropomorphic, the Gemara says, Imo anochi betzara, it says in Tehillim, I am with him in trouble. And God mourns the destruction of the temple, and that God weeps because of the exile. Of course, we're not taking these things literally. God is not a person. But at the same time, a person who is open-hearted, and when they feel the Shekhinah in exile, they feel the Shekhinah with them in exile, they see the compassion and the love of God, and they see that God's love and compassion extends to every human emotion and extends even to the lowest point, and that's why it's like water. All right. So now we're going to just talk a little bit more. Now the viceroy realized that the king was very upset. He stood up and he asked to give him a servant, a horse, and some money for expenses. So let's see how we interpret all this stuff. This would mean that those who passed the test would have the maximal reward, but it also meant that many others would fail. Okay, so this is interesting too, part of God's sadness. Since God's purpose would not be realized through these people, right? So there are going to be people in the history of humanity who do not achieve a level of real goodness and closeness with God. There's going to be the Shaim, unfortunately. It says that God grieves also for the wicked. It is thus written, God regretted that he had made man on earth, that he grieved in his heart. This is before the story of Noah, right? That God is so sad and he's mourning that the creations that he earned so much to be great, right? Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, God in search of man, that they did not live up to his hopes. Now, who is the viceroy? This is really important. Well, it could be identified as Am Yisrael as a whole. It could be seen, because why? Am Yisrael, we're Mamlechet Kohanim VeGoy Kadosh, we are God's emissaries. We're God's second in command. So we're in charge of directing the world and bringing about the final goal. I always tell people, when it says we're the chosen nation, it's not in a superiority complex. We're chosen because we have a mission, and we could, God forbid, fail in this mission. We're the viceroy. We're chosen to have a tremendous responsibility. That's what we're chosen for. So the viceroy could be all of Am Yisrael. It could also be the singular righteous man or tzaddik in each generation. Historically, we're going to see that in this story, we're going to talk about Adam and Noah in the first two trials of this viceroy. But also, of course, we can't help but think of Yosef as tzaddik. We think of the Mishneh LaMelech, the viceroy. We think of Yosef, and we say tzaddik yesod olam. And what does it make sense? It makes sense that that Yosef, who is Yesod, would be the one who is interacting and trying to save the lost princess, who is Shekhinah. Because in the realm of the Sefirot, the Yesod is the masculine, the Shekhinah is the feminine, and very often those are the ones that are copulating. Those are the ones that are getting together to join in the oneness of God. Yesod usually denotes the concept of penetration. Hence, the viceroy must penetrate the realm of evil in order to free the princess. And I wrote over here, this is the hero's journey, right? The hero's journey is all about this. It's, as Jordan Peterson would say, extending the realm of order into chaos, being courageous enough to delve into the chaos and jump in at risk to yourself for the sake of saving the princess, right? For the sake of bringing order into chaos. Since Yesod is the sixth Sefirah, it represents the sixth day of creation. So it could even be mankind as a whole, or Am Yisrael again, who is the heart of mankind. In Kabbalah, Rachel is identified as Shekhinah, and she's also in exile, brought up in the house of Lavan. And Yaakov was the Sadiq in her time to free her from her realm of evil, being in that house of trickery. And now how about the servant? This is interesting. So the viceroy has a servant, a horse, and some money. What do those represent? The servant is the soul, but even more accurately, like we'll see in our stories, in this story, is that also it represents the intellect or human logic. And we're going to see how human logic could be a guiding light at some points. But if human logic is led astray into things like cynicism, then human logic is really a very poor master. They say about the mind is a great servant, but a lousy master. We're going to see that play out with the servant of the viceroy. What's the horse? The horse is the body. And we're going to see this viceroy is going to have to give up these different elements of himself. He's going to have to give up the servant, which is the soul or the intellect. In order to approach God, you have to approach the limits of your rationalism. And to give up the horse is giving up the body. And he leaves it outside the first castle. And some money for expenses, these are like worldly goods. It could also be referring to merits or mitzvot or good deeds or good karma. When it says that he's searching for her, he's going to seek out the princess. And this is in itself a very great thing. But the forces of evil want us to feel that awareness of God is a mere illusion. Right? So this is really important. They want us to doubt this awareness of God. And where is he going? He's going to search in the midbar.
Yes, ayeting.
Say it again.
He's going to ayet now in the desert.
Exactly. It's a very common thing in the Tanakh. Yeah, also.
Mikey.
Wow. Oh, you got the book. We got to learn this together, ID. I'm coming over.
20 years, this book.
Unbelievable. You know,
ayet. This is the peak. This is Wayne Dyer's peak, Maslow's peak experience right here.
Oh, I'm so happy. It finally comes full circle, huh?
They all have the same model. It's just a different frame. That's it.
100%. Exactly right. And you know what? It's funny because I'm on the same journey as so many people. So I know so many rabbis, like white hat rabbis, as they would say. I'm not going to name names.
Right.
But white hat rabbis that I learned with when I was a teenager, who now we're reconnecting and we're all into the same stuff. We're all into Hasidut and Kabbalah and Rabbi Nachman because we grew up intellectual, but we had this thirst for, okay, once I reach the limits of my rationalism,
right,
what do I do? So this is what this story is about, giving up the intellect and realizing that that's the one at which you – it's an amazing idea.
Mikey, send this to me. Send this to me.
I 100% will. I'll send it to you. I'm going to text it to you.
Okay.
This whole story. So we'll end with this idea. This is your favorite concept, the midbar, the desert. The word midbar comes from the root davar. What does davar mean? It means ledaber, to speak, right? And that's why they say it's almost like God's words crystallized into reality. When God said or, the word or became light, because the concept of an object and speaking are the same. And to think is a thing, right? In order to have a thing, you have to think about it as a thing, as a separate thing. So what's the point of this desert? It's a place of isolation. It's a place where you go to be alone. So many of our ancestors were the Ro'etzon, Moshe Rabbeinu.
Right.
For all those years, it was like 60 years. We don't know what was going on. All we know, he was in the desert alone. Yeah. With the flock. Amazing, right? And this is your concept, ID. Hitbodedut.
No, every day for the last 30 years, when I walk to shul, I walk through the schoolyard.
Uh-huh.
The schoolyard is my desert, and I it.
I love it. I love it. That's a holy space for you and God.
Where is the connection with Likutei Moharan and Zohar? Where's the connection here?
So all these Sefirot stuff are going to apply to our understanding of the way that we learn about the Sefirot and the Zohar.
Okay, fine. I got it.
That's what I would say.
Okay.
But this idea of isolated prayer and meditation is very, very key. And it could even be that the desert alludes to faith.
Right.
Into the desert with Moshe Rabbeinu was a supreme act of faith. As Yirmiyahu recalls, he says, "Zacharti lach hesed ne'uraich, ahavat kelulotaich." He says, "I remember the time when you followed me into the desert, in the days when you were a bridegroom and I was the groom." Lichtech acharai b'midbar be'eretz lo zeru'a. When you took this leap of faith to follow me into the desert, into the land unsown. This is the epic tale of the love story between Am Yisrael and God. And that's what's going on here. This guy, this viceroy, is going to have to travel into the desert, into chaos. We'll pause here. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen. Amen.
That was wild.
Great stuff. Huh? Stay tuned.
That was freaking, you blew me out tonight, Mikey.
I love it. I'm so happy you came. I'm so happy everybody joined. This is the biggest hana'ah for me. I hope you know.
Ah, you're showering us with it.
I love it.
Mind blowing.
That's really, thank you. And Dr. Nasser, thank you for always supporting the podcast and everything. It means so much. You guys are real. You light us up, and we're like a Christmas tree, you know? We're all different lights shining together here on a Tuesday night.
Beautiful group. Thanks, guys. Have a great week, guys.
Allah ma'akum. Shavua tov.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Bye.
Uncle Richie. Oh, my God. I miss you. I see your messages now. Love you.
Love you, man.
How you been? Good? Thank you. I miss you. I wish I could have seen you on Purim, but I got to see you soon. I'm going to bring you to the banya also. By the way, I'm going tomorrow night to the banya if you want to come.
I'm having kidney stone procedure tomorrow.
Oh, my God. All right.
Yeah. I'm having the east wall of the blast.
The kidney stone should be afraid of you, Uncle Richie.
It's 1.3 centimeters.
Oh, my God. Holy cow.
That's pretty big, right?
Are they doing the lithotripsy at him? They're shocking him? Okay. Yeah. Refuah shelema. It should be painless and quick.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I hope so.
I love it. I love it. I love seeing you.
So did I get it right?
With which thing?
My second
comment. You wrote here. Cursing always makes me feel better, and the perfect understanding of God is not understanding. The cursing thing is for sure true. And then they say psychologically that's true. The perfect understanding of God is not understanding. You hit the nail on the head. That's when you know, is when you know you don't know. It's because there's nothing to understand. When you think you could wrap your mind around it, you can't, and you realize that.
That's why I just sent it in a message. I didn't want to, like, you know, interrupt, you know, your flow. No, and you know what they say. When you learn how to drive, you learn how to curse.
That's exactly right. Oh, my God. It's a madhouse.
I look forward to seeing you in the very near future. It's been too long.
100%. 100%. If Ashlema, and when I do see you, we'll celebrate. We'll celebrate your good health.
Thank you. Thank you. I love you. I love you.
Be well. All right. I'm going to text you. You let me know how it goes. What time is the procedure?
8:15. How long should it be about? What do you think?
I don't know. It's a good question. Probably not too long. I would say maybe an hour. I really don't think it would be a long
one. They're going to put me out.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. So maybe a little longer. Maybe I would say probably still an hour.
Yeah. They don't. They give you what's it called? Propofol?
Yeah. Propofol. Nice.
All right.
Beautiful.
I'll be in touch. Okay.
Love it. I love it. Love you. Feel good.
Take care. Good night. Bye. Come on.